From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The shooting in Boulder, Colorado, where 10 people were killed, has reignited the national conversation on gun laws. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris on CBS This Morning.
It is time for Congress to act and stop with the false choices. This is not about getting rid of the Second Amendment. It's simply about saying we need reasonable gun safety laws. There is no reason why we have assault weapons on the streets of a civil society. They are weapons of war. They are designed to kill a lot of people quickly.
Let's bring in Ben Marcus with Colorado Public Radio. He's been covering the shooting there in Colorado. And Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with what we know today. What have you heard, if anything, about what motivated this accused shooter?
We still frustratingly don't have those details. We have been spending a lot of time reporting on the suspect, though. His name is Ahmaud Alyssa, according to authorities. He's 21 years old. According to Colorado arrest records that we have, he was born in Syria, but he is a U.S. citizen, went to high school here in Colorado in a neighboring suburb to Boulder called Arvada. He was on the wrestling team there, and people we spoke to who knew him from those wrestling days said that one of the defining features of him was that he was prone to angry outbursts. One person described it as an anger management problem, but he could usually be talked down. We did find an arrest record from November of 2017. Where he assaulted a high school classmate, walked across the classroom apparently unprovoked, and then started punching on this classmate. He was sentenced to 1 year probation and anger management classes.
Colorado is now in a state of mourning. I mean, the country is, but can you tell us more about what we've learned about the victims?
Well, it appears to be random at this point. We're not sure what motivated the attack, if he targeted this King Soopers, if he knew people there. King Soopers is all over the Colorado metro, Denver metro area here in Colorado. And so why he picked one 15 miles from his home is still a mystery. We know the victims range in age from 20 to 65 years old, people who worked there, people who were there getting groceries. Again, there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. And we're back into this cycle of trying to search for answers while also playing up the lives of the people who were lost.
Ben, let's talk about guns for a moment. We heard Vice President Kamala Harris. We've also heard from your senator, John Hickenlooper, who called on Congress to pass new legislation. What do we know about the gun used in this case?
So this is interesting. It appears to be a Ruger AR-556 pistol variant. It looks so much like an AR-15 assault rifle that the police, when they initially cataloged the suspect's belongings, they called it a possible AR-15. I've never seen anything like this. It's a pistol, but with a brace that's added to it and scope. It looks a lot like an assault rifle. It's described by some reviewers on YouTube as an entry-level or budget-priced assault weapon. The date of the purchase is also interesting. He bought it the same day that there was a shooting rampage in Georgia where 8 people died in spas around the Atlanta metro area. We're not sure if that's a coincidence, but that appears to line up.
Authorities have been giving these press briefings. Have they told you when they'll be able to have another one to give updates on the investigation?
Yeah, they say they're going to have another update later this afternoon, and the updates have been frustrating. We just don't have much information about what's going on. They even delayed telling us how many people were actually killed initially, even though they knew that. And so there's always delays. We've covered a lot of these mass shootings now. It's always frustrating, but this is a little bit more opaque and mysterious than usual.
You mentioned that you've covered several of these on a personal level. How are you dealing with this? You've covered many of them.
Well, you learn to compartmentalize. When I got into journalism, I didn't think I would be covering so many mass shootings. When I got to Colorado, editors talked about Columbine. For me, the big mass shooting was the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012, the Planned Parenthood shooting in Colorado Springs a year or so later. Several school shootings, the Arapahoe school shooting, the STEM school shooting in Highlands Ranch, and now the Boulder school this Boulder supermarket shooting. We come to define our careers to some degree in journalism by mass shootings now. Different generations of reporters come in and have a different large-scale mass shooting tragedy to cover. And so we're becoming pretty practiced at this, unfortunately.
Ben Marcus is with Colorado Public Radio. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Top public health officials are questioning the promising COVID-19 vaccine data reported this week by AstraZeneca. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease says the company may have used outdated information when reporting its vaccine was 79% effective against the coronavirus in a clinical trial. More recent data indicate the vaccine may be slightly less effective. Matt Herper is following the story for our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. He joins us with the latest. And Matt, what exactly does the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease mean by outdated information?
There are two things at play here. One is whether the data are up to date and whether they were overstated. The other is the integrity and oversight of this clinical trial. Trials are monitored by a board called a DSMB, a Data Safety Monitoring Board. And that's actually a very important check in this process for making sure that patients in the trial are protected and the integrity is held. And what happens, the DSMB sent a letter CCing Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health, saying that they disagreed with the choice AstraZeneca had made of where in the trial they were releasing information, saying that new data had emerged and that that 79% number seemed as if it might decrease. The other issue is that normally when a DSMB says something, the company's supposed to listen, and that doesn't seem to have been happening. So there's both a chance that these data are outdated and may come down a bit, although it doesn't sound like anyone's saying that the vaccine would not be effective.
So this letter from the monitoring board that you mentioned was pretty harsh. I mean, Dr. Fauci told your publication that this was an unforced error by the company. And the letter says, quote, that decisions like this are what erode public trust in the scientific process. So, you know, I mean, vaccine skepticism is already a challenge, Matt. And public health officials here seem to be suggesting that this AstraZeneca saga could make matters worse.
Normally, when a press release is sent out, the DSMB has okayed it. So this is a very strange situation where AstraZeneca is making proclamations without checking all the boxes, and is upsetting also because one of the things that we're looking to this trial to do is there's been a lot of noise about the AstraZeneca vaccine. There were worries about side effects, blood clots, which do not seem to have actually been a problem at the large scale. There may be some rare conditions, very rare, that regulators in Europe are still looking into. So having this kind of procedural mishap happen, it's not a good look, as they say.
So how is AstraZeneca responding to the criticism then? And what is the prospect now that the FDA will in fact grant emergency use authorization for this vaccine in the first half of April?
Well, we're still waiting on a real response from AstraZeneca. They said that there would be one within 48 hours. The FDA will make a decision after AstraZeneca files its data to the FDA, and the FDA independently analyzes them and will then share those in not a press release, but like a 100-page document, which will then be analyzed, as we saw with the other vaccines, by a panel of outside experts in public. And after that, the FDA makes its decision, and this is why that process exists. It's also important for people in the U.S. to know that this is all happening on a timeline such that we will probably have enough supply for every adult, according to the Biden administration, and those numbers seem to check out.
Well, let me ask you about that, Matt. I mean, is it possible that the FDA's view will end up being something of a moot point because, as you mentioned, there are three other companies that already have emergency use authorizations for their vaccines, J&J, Pfizer, Moderna, and the Biden administration has said that there will be enough doses for every American within weeks. So by the time this AstraZeneca vaccine would be available in the U.S., perhaps we wouldn't even need it. And if that's the case, should we send the doses to other countries?
That is a very good question and something that is being debated right now. Ashish Jha from the Brown School of Public Health has said, these doses that we already have, we're not going to need people need them in other countries where the vaccine is authorized now. We should send them there. And that's the timeline is such that it will take a while to get this, to do this EUA process. And these kind of issues are only make it more important that that process goes forward. I also would expect some people to complain that the FDA should speed that process up even more than it has. So I think there will be a lot of tension around this, but there's certainly an argument for giving those doses to people in other places.
Matt Herper is a senior writer with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Cases involving guns are on the agenda of the U.S. Supreme Court this week as the nation mourns the loss of human life in two more mass shootings. Today, justices hear arguments in a case about a domestic dispute in Rhode Island where police seized a man's guns in his home without a warrant. And on Friday, justices will decide on whether to take up a case involving gun permits in New York State that require the applicant to prove the need to carry a weapon. Joining us now is Supreme Court watcher Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and senior research scholar at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Today's cases involves a fight between a married couple. He threw an unloaded gun on a table during an argument and said, "Why don't you just shoot me and get me out of my misery?" She left the house in fear, and police who responded took his guns away without a warrant. What's at stake in this case?
What's at stake in this case is whether the Supreme Court will extend situations inside somebody's home where the police can do a search and seize, in this case, guns without a warrant. So the question here is whether the police should have had a warrant before they took these guns out of the home.
But there's something called the community caretaking exception, which is central to this case. Can you explain that and what both sides are saying about it?
Yeah, sure. So in theory, you don't get to do a search and seizure if you're the police unless you have a warrant. In practice, there are a lot of exceptions to that rule. And so the question in this case is, what does this exception called community caretaking amount to? In a lot of the previous cases, this has been more about cars, whether the cops can search a car that, you know, has been towed and impounded, for example. Extending a community caretaking exception inside the home makes civil libertarians really nervous. You could imagine the police kind of storming in. You're giving them a lot more leeway and power inside someone's house. On the other hand, this was a, you know, kind of potential domestic violence or even suicidal situation in which you might want the police to be able to take away someone's guns. And so the question is whether this idea of community caretaking extends to this kind of scenario.
Right. You mentioned the concern by civil liberties groups. Well, many of them are siding with gun rights organizations on this case. Which way do you think the court will go? I mean, what do you know about where the newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, actually stands on gun rights?
You know, Amy Coney Barrett's record on search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment, I think, is really to be determined. And so that will be one big question we'll find out more about when the court rules. You know, based on the arguments today, I think a lot of the justices were nervous about giving the police a lot of broad power to come inside people's houses in a non-emergency situation. This wasn't an emergency where the cops could say, "We had to take these guns right the second," because the husband in the case was already in custody. And so, you know, why not require the police to get a warrant if they have time to do so? I think that the justices will probably, you know, start from that premise, especially because we're talking about going inside someone's home.
On Friday, justices will decide whether to take up a Second Amendment right to bear arms case involving a New York State law. It says anyone applying for a permit to carry a concealed handgun in public in New York State has to prove an actual and articulable need to do so. Who is challenging this law?
So a bunch of people who applied for permits to carry concealed weapons outside their houses are challenging this law, and they're saying that New York makes it way too hard to get a permit to carry a gun outside your house. And it's true that the state requires you to basically show a special need for self-protection that's different from just being an ordinary person. And so is that okay? Can states make it tough to get a permit to carry a gun? Or does the Second Amendment mean that if you have a kind of ordinary desire or need to carry a gun outside your house, that the state should really respect your right to do so? And that is a huge question for gun regulation going forward, and one the Supreme Court until now has really left open.
Yeah, a huge question. I mean, how big of a deal would it be if justices decide to take up this case?
It will be a very big deal. So, you know, for the last several years, there's been a fight going on in the Supreme Court. Some of the most conservative justices have been very eager to expand Second Amendment rights and take a case just like this. And until Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed, it didn't seem like there was a majority of justices who were ready for that case. But now she's on the court, and this one is being teed up by a very prominent conservative lawyer, Paul Clement. And so you can see here an effort to get the court to start really limiting what states can do in terms of restricting permitted gun ownership. And I should add that, you know, New York's low rate of gun ownership, lots of research has tied that to a relatively low rate of shootings and homicides in New York. And so there's really a lot at stake here.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and senior research scholar at Yale Law School. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks so much.
A Democratic House candidate in Iowa, whose race was decided by just 6 votes, is appealing to Congress for another ruling on who really won. Her opponent, Republican Marionette Miller Meeks, was certified as the representative of Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, but Democrat Rita Hart has challenged that result in court, and now she's taking her case to Washington. Reporter Kate Payne has been following this for Iowa Public Radio. Hey, Kate.
Hi.
So help me understand what's going on here, because Republican Marionette Miller Meeks won by 6 votes in November's election. She is now serving as the congresswoman for Iowa's 2nd District. It would seem to be over. So what is Hart's case exactly? She's saying the count was inaccurate?
That's right. So Democrat Rita Hart and her legal team have identified 22 ballots that they believe were legally cast but were incorrectly left out of this count. And when you have a margin of 6 votes, it doesn't take a whole lot to change that outcome. And so Rita Hart has been pressuring this House committee to take another look at this race. And ultimately, Hart hopes to have actually a full hand recount of the entire race, and ultimately hopes to take that seat in Congress.
I see. But part of what's so striking here is that Hart has declined to appeal through state channels and is instead taking her challenge directly to the House of Representatives. Now, there is a history to this. The House Administration Committee overturned dozens of election results back in the 1800s, but the practice is basically defunct today. So if it were to be revived, how does it work?
As you say, it is a relatively rare situation that candidates should make this appeal to the House, but it is something that's happened repeatedly, something like 90 cases in the past 100 years of candidates doing this. Ultimately, as you say, you know, Republicans have continued to criticize Hart for not first going to a state court and making her case there. And they say that she's choosing a political process going through the democratically controlled House, as opposed to making her case in front of a panel of state judges. But ultimately, in going to the House, this challenge is up to the Committee on House Administration. And ultimately, that committee could set up a process where they could do a full recount. And then ultimately, that committee will make their final report, their final recommendation, which could go to the full House for a vote on a simple majority.
I see. So that's what Republicans are saying. They don't like the process here, and they have some concern about a Democratic-controlled House being the arbiter here. But how do Democrats respond to those concerns? And do they say that they have a case here that's more than just a political sour grapes?
So Rita Hart has maintained that the reason that she went to the House is because under state law, the timeline wouldn't have given her enough time to have this full recount, this full review that she's looking for, and that it's the House's responsibility to ensure that every vote was counted and to ensure that ultimately the right member of Congress is sitting in that seat.
I know the House Administration Committee has given the two candidates until this coming Monday to submit written answers to several questions. And then what happens after that? I mean, do we know how likely it is that the House will actually take up this case and render a decision?
Yes. Yeah, so both sides have been answering a series of questions from the committee, and they face a deadline next Monday to respond to each other's arguments so far. Ultimately, it's sort of an open question of how the House committee will move forward. The chair of that committee, Zoe Lofgren, has maintained that no one can confidently say who has won this race, that there's a lot that needs to be done to fully air out this challenge. And she certainly seems inclined to move forward with this. But it is something that's become increasingly politically tense, I would say. Just in recent days, we're seeing some moderate Democrats in the House coming forward and saying they're not comfortable with this. There's been reporting that some House Democrats, vulnerable Democrats, are worried that this could be used against them in their own reelection efforts in 2022. Meanwhile, Republicans are trying to make it as difficult as possible for those members to weigh in on what they see as overturning an election of a seated member of Congress.
So the election not over yet in Iowa. Plenty more to watch in the coming weeks. That's Kate Payne with Iowa Public Radio. Thanks for bringing us the latest.
Thanks so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just catch you up on the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, whether it's how to tackle the challenges that come with pregnancy during a pandemic or how to understand the crisis unfolding along our southern border. We'll fill you in for 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
When Sheryl Sandford's son, Emmanuel, was shot and killed in Washington, D.C. in 2009, she had more than just photographs of him or voicemails. She had a trove of home video footage from the last decade of his life, so she worked with a team of collaborators to make a film called 17 Blocks. The film is now available for streaming from over 100 theaters nationally. And Jenny Gathright of member station WAMU reports.
In the days after her son's death, Sheryl Sandford was already talking with her family friend, the filmmaker Davey Rothbart, about making a documentary. She thought their unique collection of video footage could make a difference.
We had footage of my son from his childhood, and I just knew in my heart that I could show people that you'll get to know this person, and you'll just see that we've been robbed.
You immediately recognized the value that all that footage we had collected over the years could have in terms of helping the vast scope of this problem, like, really hit home for people.
That's Rothbart. He met Sanford's son, Emmanuel Durant Jr., and his older brother Smurf at a basketball court in Southeast D.C. in 1999. Emmanuel was 9 at the time. Rothbart had recently graduated from college, and he had just gotten his first video camera. He became friends with the family, and they started chronicling their lives.
Smurf, come here. You can record yourself.
That's Emmanuel.
My name is Emmanuel. I'm 9. My subject is math and reading, English, social studies, PE, and talking on the phone, playing basketball, and I'm a superstar.
Sanford says Emmanuel really took to the camera.
He had it the whole summer, you know, when he first met Davey. From after that point, all of the school year. So he basically lived and breathed camera.
10 years later, in 2009, Emmanuel graduated high school and started training to be a firefighter. Here he is again in the footage.
I graduated from the Theodore Roosevelt Senior High School. And then I got a scholarship from Kappa Foundation. Felt good.
And then, on New Year's Eve of that year, he was shot and killed while trying to defend the house from robbers who had followed Smurf home. Suddenly, Sanford could relate to friends she knew who had lost their children to gun violence. She thought she could help do everyone's stories justice by showing the impact this violence had on her family.
I was trying to convey everybody's story with my story. And maybe we can get a message to these people who pick these guns up and decide that they have to shoot to kill, that maybe we can show them there's a value to life.
So after his death, the family kept filming for 10 more years as they grieved and healed, too. The documentary shows how poverty and trauma continue to affect the Sanford family. Rothbart says the film is asking people in power to address the systemic racism and economic inequality that drives gun violence's disproportionate impact on Black families like the Sanfords. That's why they named it 17 Blocks, the distance from the U.S. Capitol to the home the family lived in when Rothbart first met them.
The title 17 Blocks is a challenge to allocate resources in ways that can help people in these neighborhoods and help not just reduce gun violence, but just create more opportunity across the board.
Because Sanford says she doesn't want to see families continue to go through what she did. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Gathright.
NBC Sports, CBS Sports, Sports welcomes you to the following presentation of the National Football League.
The NFL has just signed a batch of broadcast deals worth more than $100 billion, and the agreements kick in 2023. Stephen Battaglio writes about television and the media business for the Los Angeles Times and joins us. Stephen, how would you sum up these deals? I mean, more than $100 billion is a big number. What are the highlights?
The number represents what football is to television, traditional television, and also streaming. This deal keeps the NFL on what they call broadcast TV, also cable TV, for the next 11 years. But it will also begin to recognize the trend toward people who don't watch on regular TV, who are using services like Amazon Prime. They will have the Thursday Night Football package starting in 2023. It'll be the first time that the NFL gives a package of games to a streaming outlet. They've sampled here and there over the years, but every week, if you want to watch Thursday Night Football, except if you're in the local market, you have to watch it on Amazon Prime. You have to be a Prime member.
Yeah, this is a big shift because, as you say, some viewers may have watched games in the past using Prime or some other streaming service, but that was sort of an alternative to a game that was also being carried over the air or on cable, and that won't always necessarily be the case with Amazon Prime going forward. I'll just mention Amazon is one of NPR's financial supporters. But, Stephen, I'm hoping you can help us see the bigger picture here, because with the NFL trying to balance this shift towards streaming with maintaining relationships with traditional networks like CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox, the broadcast TV landscape is changing. What do you see as the bigger picture here?
Viewers, especially younger viewers, are watching sitcoms, dramas, and movies on streaming services, especially in the last year with the pandemic. Football still draws people to traditional TV. You do have to show up to watch a game live, to enjoy it with your friends, to be able to talk about it, and most importantly for a lot of people, to be able to bet on it. And the NFL does not see that diminishing in the anytime soon. However, they do recognize that younger people may not be finding the NFL because they don't watch regular TV. And by the way, all of the networks that have broadcast deals have streaming platforms as well. And all of those services are going to carry games.
Well, could you see a future then, Stephen, where we actually have more games being streamed than broadcast? And if so, is there some concern there? I mean, I realize that these paid streaming services don't cost a fortune, but one of the beauties of NFL games, up until now at least, has been that you can get it for free with the old rabbit ears.
You can. And if the NFL was to take a major package and put it on a streaming service now, you would be disenfranchising a lot of fans. Not everyone across the country has high-speed internet that can support a streaming service. I should note that this is an 11-year contract, and in the seventh year, the NFL can opt out. I'm sure that in the years leading up to that opt-out period, they're going to take a good look at what the landscape looks like.
You know, one of the notable things about the Amazon Prime broadcasts in recent years is they had used an all-female play-by-play booth for the first time. Andrea Kramer and Hannah Storm were calling those games. But that was offered as an alternative to the TV pairing of Joe Buck and Troy Aikman that was going out over the air. And I'm wondering, Stephen, now that Amazon has the exclusive rights to Thursday Night Football and there will no longer be the over-the-air telecast that goes along with it, should we expect Amazon to stick with Kramer and Storm?
I would imagine that they would probably provide multiple offerings. Amazon, $1.5 billion a year is not a lot to them at this point, and they learn so much more in terms of what they can deliver to fans. And, you know, you're bringing a lot of people into the Amazon store, making a lot of people be Amazon Prime members if they want to watch this game. It's a lot of opportunity for them to try different things.
Stephen Battaglio covers the media business for the Los Angeles Times. Stephen, thanks for talking with us about the latest big money TV deals for the NFL.
My pleasure.
Cougars are hard to track, but sightings of them are on the rise in Northeast Washington State. That's according to one researcher who is working to ensure that cougars avoid people, pets, and livestock. His tools, dogs, and podcasts. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Courtney Flatt has the story.
Those hounds you hear are about a quarter of a mile away, but their baying echoes throughout the hills near the reservation of the Kalispell tribe. Whisperer Tipsy and Boone are on the scent of a cougar.
So we should hear the dogs coming, as if on cue.
Come here, girls.
Bart George is the wildlife program manager for the Kalispell tribe. He calls this part of Northeast Washington State a cougar hotspot.
We're seeing more depredations, more pets and small livestock, particularly goats and llamas and things like that being killed.
The tribe wanted to find a way to calm things down. George says the tribe is also unhappy that after a cougar kills a pet or livestock, the state discards the animal's carcass. The tribe hunts cougars using the meat, bones, and hide.
We don't want to see cats be wasted that way. It's a kind of a disrespectful thing to happen to such a charismatic species.
So George is trying to reinforce the big cat's instinct to stay away from nearby neighbors and their property by making them wary of human stimuli. He's hazing the cougars so they have a negative association with people.
We're really teaching them to be wary of humans.
George collars the cougars and attaches an additional Garmin tracker. That transmits location data every 2 seconds after he remotely turns on the device.
Here she is, right above us.
Right now, George is tracking an 85-pound cougar on a hillside. The team collared her about a week before.
I don't want to walk straight up at her. I'd rather walk at her laterally on a side hill just to let her move in a more natural way.
First, George will use Bluetooth speakers to play a hunting podcast called The Meat Eater at 80 decibels.
So I'll turn this radio on when I get to 400 yards.
He hopes loud voices will cause the cat to run. George monitors the cougar's location the whole hike.
446 yards from her.
As soon as the cougar takes off, he'll wait to see how far she'll travel. He counts down the distance as we keep hiking closer. 400 yards.
This is the Meat Eater podcast.
250 yards. 218 yards. We keep our eyes peeled. Podcast host Steve Ranella's voice drones on.
And the rule here is it has to have three on one side.
Yeah.
39 yards. We stop. This cougar isn't quite sure what to do. Then she starts moving, and the hound handlers release their dogs. Their howls grow more frantic as the chase picks up. These dogs finally trap the cougar. They circle the base of the tree she's climbed. The cougar peers down from 50 feet up in the branches. George will haze this cougar about once a week for a month. His research isn't finished, but he says so far, the cats are fleeing farther from the sound of the podcast each time they're hazed.
By the end of the project, when they hear us, they're basically twice as far away and they're running. So that's what we want to see.
But there are some skeptics of George's tactics. Rosemary Sciano is a wildlife biologist who often works with the Mountain Lion Foundation. She says the hazing won't change cougar behavior if the cats aren't hazed at the moment they're causing problems.
They're out about on the land on part of their home range, and they're not actually tied to, say, a depredation incident. I don't think that's healthy for the mountain lions, and I don't think that ultimately will have the effect that they're trying to gain.
The Humane Society of the United States says using hounds to track and trap cougars can unduly stress the cats. The advocacy group also worries that cougars and hounds could be injured or killed during these chases. George says people in this part of northeastern Washington are nervous about cougars. He says they need to learn how to better protect their livestock and pets, something he tries to teach. As the team treed this cougar, four neighbors heard the dogs bang and came over to see what had happened.
Come on over if you want to see this cat.
They were waiting.
Yeah, we got a cougar treed. Come on over and take a look if you'd like.
One neighbor carried a gun.
Do you think she'll hang around here? Stay?
Yep, she'll make a living here.
As long as she behaves, that's what you want.
As long as she
though.
Behaves, that's
no matter
fine.
What, no matter what, you're going to have a cat here, so hopefully it's a good one. You know?
I figured we had cats. Oh, I just don't want another one on my porch.
All right.
Driving to his next location to track another cougar, George says people have made it easy for cougars to be tempted by livestock, by pets.
We've created this situation where the deer live down in the valleys and the cougars don't have a choice but to come down to the valleys where the people are to hunt. So now we just have to figure out how to coexist to some degree.
How exactly to do that is still a big question. For Here and Now, I'm Courtney Flatt.
One of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar, Passover, begins this Saturday. It's a celebration with many deeply rooted food traditions, one of which comes up with a festive dessert a little bit harder. And Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz has a few suggestions to help, and she joins us now. Kathy, welcome back.
Thank you, Tanya.
So last year, at the start of the pandemic, Passover was a virtual celebration for many families, including yours. Will you still be doing it that way this year?
Sadly, we will. It's still too soon to gather around the table in person, but I have great hopes for next year. We'll be doing it online, but it will still be a celebration. And it's really a beautiful holiday with songs and readings and rituals and traditional foods. And as you mentioned, dessert gets a bit complicated because according to Jewish tradition, leavened foods, anything using yeast or wheat flour, barley, rye, oats, or spelt are not eaten during Passover. And
so many of those traditional recipes of cakes and cookies are out.
Exactly. So you have to be very creative. I just briefly wanted to explain why that is. The holiday commemorates the biblical story of Exodus when Moses rescued the Israelites from a life of slavery under Pharaoh in Egypt. And according to the story, when the Israelites were leaving Egypt, they did so in such a hurry that the bread they had baked for the journey did not have time to rise. And so now we eat unleavened bread, also called matzah, which is this cracker-like flatbread. And the reason that's okay, even though it's made with flour and water, is that it's only allowed to sit for less than 18 minutes before cooking under the supervision of a rabbi.
Oh, well, thank you for that context. Well, you've brought us recipes that don't use leavening, including two that use egg whites to give lift to them. Tell us about them.
These are great spring recipes for Passover or any spring feast. The first is a coconut macaroon, which is a cookie, and there are many variations on this. All you do is whip egg white with a touch of salt, and you slowly add sugar and keep whipping it, and then you fold in shredded coconut, and you make these little cookies, and you bake them. You could also fold in chocolate chips or toasted finely ground nuts. Once they come out of the oven, you let them cool, and you can dip them into dark or semi-sweet chocolate, sprinkle them with toasted coconuts. Love, love these macaroons. And you can make these with a five-year-old. Very simple.
Okay, they're very simple. Okay, I'll take your word for that. The unleavening flatbread matzah, as you mentioned, is such a big part of the Passover meal. You've also created a dessert out of it.
I did. So many of you might remember during the holidays, I always talk about my butter crunch. I thought, what if you made butter crunch on top of matzah? So I made a caramel, mixing sugar and butter and corn syrup until it reached 290 on my candy thermometer, spread it on a matzah, then sprinkled some toasted pistachios on top. And then I melted some chocolate and drizzled it on kind of in a Jackson Pollock-like design using the tines of a fork. And I left the other side of the matzo plain, and it's sweet and crunchy, and then it gets sea salt. And oh my goodness, there's nothing about deprivation when you talk about this matzo brittle.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, the idea of making a caramel might be a little scary for some listeners. It is for me. I have failed like 3 times. I quit. What tips can you give us?
Okay, you just need a candy thermometer. You need to just follow the temperature. You just throw this butter and corn syrup and sugar and a touch of water in a pan, and you don't touch it. You sit there and watch the thermometer, and the minute it hits 290, you are there. You are at the perfect moment to spread it on the matzo.
Okay, I only have about a minute with you. What other dessert ideas do you have for us?
Well, every year I make a Passover meringue cake. Again, beaten egg whites and sugar. You let the egg whites get quite stiff, and then you bake it in a circle. And what you do is you use your spoon to push the middle out along the sides so that you're creating a kind of crater or a hollow. You bake it, and then once that comes out of the oven, it cooks slow at 225 for an hour and a half, and then you leave it in the oven turned off till it's crisp and dry. Fill it with whipped cream and seasonal strawberries. Again, just a gorgeous centerpiece for Easter as well, or any spring holiday.
We've been talking Passover dessert recipes with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We will have all of Kathy's recipes and ideas at hereandnow.org. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.